I think Gordon Sondland right now is above Wales. Wales on the west coast of Great Britain.
Hello and welcome to this debate reaction episode of the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and this is actually our second podcast of the day. So after you listen to this one, if you haven't yet listened to our Gordon Sondland testimony reaction podcast, listen to that one. I honestly don't even know what day it is anymore, but we just wrapped up the fifth Democratic primary debate. There were 10 candidates on stage. They covered a lot of issues, roughly 15 by my count. But notably, they talked little about impeachment. So a change of topic for everyone with this podcast. But we're going to get into the takeaways from the debate, you know, who did well, who did poorly, what comes next. And here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going?
It's going well. I'm currently tracking Gordon Sondland's flight from Dulles to Brussels, and I think he's somewhere over Greenland right now, probably.
Oh, how much longer is in his flight?
I am looking. Here, introduce the other guests, and I'll give you a more precise update here.
All right, and just for listeners at home, you've heard little from Nate Silver during the past few days that we've been covering the impeachment hearings. He's been hiding away working on the Democratic primary model, but he's joined us for the primary.
Okay, he's over debate. He's over like Cork or Shannon, Ireland right now, an hour and a half to go. They did not take as nearly a route up to Greenland. I really screwed that up. He's in Ireland.
We should turn this into a live Gordon Sondland tracking podcast. Keep us updated if his plane kind of does anything weird or whatever. You can just give us updates throughout the podcast.
Yeah.
Anyway, also here with us is our politics editor, Sarah Frostenson, joining us from, as usual, the great state of Texas. How's it going, Sarah?
Good. Hey, Galen. Hey, Nate.
Hey there.
I just have to add in where you're joining us from because I'm a really big fan of Texas, and I'm kind of jealous of you for living in Texas.
Understandable. Need another debate here.
For sure. Let's get to it. Nate, what was your top line takeaway from the debate? Winners, losers?
I mean, my top line takeaway was I was surprised in some sense by the lack of conflict. You both had candidates opt out of, it seemed like, except for Tulsi Gabbard, avenues to attack Pete Buttigieg, where the narrative expectation going in was a lot of people would. You know, there are other frontrunners, though, and there wasn't really a lot of attacks on Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, or Bernie Sanders either. So that's kind of one takeaway. Another takeaway, you know, I thought that Cory Booker and Amy Klobuchar had strong evenings, especially Klobuchar in the first half, maybe Booker in the second half. Klobuchar has a little bit of traction in Iowa, enough where you're kind of out of that gravity near 0%. And you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe you get another kind of favorable news cycle or two and you could actually be more of a factor. Booker, obviously, because he does not have a single qualifying poll for the December debate, is in somewhat more dire straits. Among the front runners, I mean, I suppose it's good for Buttigieg that he was not attacked, really. I
think one notable exception, or a couple notable exceptions.
Klobuchar was, Klobuchar was, I think, effective at drawing contrast with him on experience and kind of electability. Booker had like a lot of, some people were calling them like kind of subtweets, meaning like he was clearly saying things about Buttigieg without kind of attacking him by name, because Cory Booker's supposed to be the kind of affable guy, although Booker has gone after Biden, for example.
And then Gabbard was more directly attacking Gabbard him on is, military
I
know, policy.
I don't want like the Gabbard fans coming after this podcast, but you know, I think if you had to pick one person, if you're Pete Buttigieg, to attack you, then Tulsi Gabbard would be one that you would be happy to have attack you, I think. And so tactically it went well for him. I don't think he was particularly strong, but he was fine.
We're going to get a lot more into what happened throughout the debate, but let's get Sarah in here. What was your top line takeaway?
Honestly, I think my top lines were pretty similar to Nate's, which is boring, kind of like the debate. I mean, it was interesting that it seemed as if the moderators purposefully were trying to ask the candidates different questions, right? Which then limited the amount they could really spar with each other. Yeah, I mean, I think Buttigieg had a fine performance, but it wasn't anything that you know, seemed as if, like in the last debate, he really took on Warren, right? He took on her stance on healthcare. He was like, you know, your policy plan isn't necessarily what we need moving forward. You didn't see that in this debate as much. I thought Booker had a really great line. He had a couple great lines, especially with taking Biden to task on, you know, legalizing marijuana. But it just, as Nate said, he doesn't have a single qualifying poll here for December, and they've got to hit 4%. And I believe the last time he hit 4% nationally was in October, in early October. And it just, that seems to me like a really hard threshold for him to cross moving forward.
Yeah, I think he might need like a intervention in the sense of like someone, because he has connections in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, the tri-state area, as we call it. Actually, we don't call it that usually. But, you know, he ought to be able to raise quite a bit of money. Maybe that means some higher donor fundraising or opening himself up to more explicit super PAC backing, right? He did it at the kind of very start, have a line about we have to build entrepreneurship, and that seemed kind of pretty catered to what we somewhat derisively referred to as the kind of Morning Joe slash Acela crowd, right? But he was drawing a contrast with Warren.
On the wealth tax, that was. They asked Booker, do you support Warren's wealth tax? And he said,
on the wealth tax, he said, no, but went a step further and said, we have to, you know, figure out how to make new entrepreneurs and new entrepreneurship, right? But like Klobuchar, look, I mean, I've been doing like a lot of work. The reason why I haven't been covering the hearings is I've been doing a lot of work on the primary model, right? And believe it or not, it sounds dumb, but being at 3 or 4% nationally and 5 or 6% in Iowa is actually like quite a bit better than being at 1 or 2%. In both states. It does mean that you're kind of like, you're on the radar a little bit. And when you're on the radar, that you can kind of, you know, I compare it to like a poker tournament, like everything, right? If you have enough chips that you can win your all-in bets, right, and double up a couple of times and actually be a contender, right? Booker's at the point where he could double his numbers and still kind of be at 3%, right?
Yeah.
If Klobuchar doubled her numbers, she would be kind of on the fringes of contention, actually, in Iowa, almost. You know, it was surprising to me that there wasn't more conflict. I'm just going to be honest. I did not love the way the debate was moderated. I thought there were opportunities for the candidates to engage with one another. I think it's what a debate is about. And MSNBC turned those down a lot of the time. I thought, you know, for better or worse, there's this argument about healthcare in every debate. But healthcare is an issue where both as substance and as symbol, you have had a lot of Democrats try to differentiate themselves on healthcare, right? And you had only a kind of short segment on healthcare when there's been a lot of news on healthcare with Elizabeth Warren issuing a Medicare for All financing plan and also kind of issuing a second plan that says, oh, here's how we do the public option, right? Like, I'm surprised that wasn't more of a subject of attention, and that, like, and that Mayor Pete in particular, one of the four leading candidates in the race, leading in Iowa, arguably, didn't get to weigh in on healthcare seemed like a pretty big oversight, potentially.
Yeah. 538 contributor Julia Azari was live blogging with us during the debate, and one of the things that she noted was that this debate has been more about emphasizing the different qualifications and characteristics than the candidate of the candidates than it has been about this left versus center debate that we saw earlier on. Do you agree with that characterization of the debate?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it seemed as if there was a departure in terms of the candidates trying to push each other further to the left. Like that phase of the primary, particularly, and I think this was back when it was like two nights, 20 candidates, you know, raising their hands like, yes, let's decriminalize crossing at the border. Like those days seem to be behind us. And then in terms of the question you're asking and like staking the lanes and what that looked like in the party, I guess because Klobuchar did have a good night, I think. And I also thought Booker, who seemed to be pivoting more towards the center, particularly with his attack on the wealth tax and the feasibility of that, that seemed to me to be the stronger moment. And maybe too, because so little time was spent on healthcare, we didn't really have the same discussions about like, well, how will you pay for that? How will you get that done? And so by being less ambitious, perhaps, in some of the proposals that were discussed tonight, the moderates won by default, if that makes sense.
Is that a fair, if we're going to look at it in terms of two different camps within the Democratic Party, is it fair to say that the moderates won?
I don't know. I haven't talked much about Warren, Sanders, or Biden. I thought Sanders was pretty consistent. I actually think, for some reason, he's been like better in these two debates since he left the trail with the heart attack. I thought last one was a little bit stronger than this one. This one was a little bit kind of more reverting to the mean of kind of yelly, kind of one note, but always pretty effective and on the ball, Bernie, right? Whereas in the last bit, he was quite good, I think. He was pretty good in this one. You know, Biden made some very strange and unfortunate kind of gaffes at the end. One about, like, I was like literally typing, okay, here's a Me Too question for Biden. This has the potential for error or comic relief or some intersection there, right? And I'm like, but that didn't happen, right? This was kind of a potential landmine that he avoided. And then he kind of used the word, like, punching three times in reference to domestic violence, and other candidates kind of snickered, and he didn't get that they were snickering at him and not with him, right? Then had another strange exchange where he kind of misspoke and said he had been vouched for or endorsed by the only African-American woman senator ever elected. Actually, it was not the only one. It was the first one, Carol Moseley Braun, but not the only one because Kamala Harris was standing there on stage with Biden. I think, like, especially the punching thing, it's probably more of a thing that people on Twitter will joke about and that won't affect his voters. There is this whole other kind of campaign going on for how do you appeal to donors, how do you appeal to media elites, to party elites, right? And I don't think it'll quiet the talk that, hey, maybe Biden looks good on paper, but not performing well enough. I don't think it'll quiet that talk, although I think that, frankly, the cable news buzz I've seen was better for Biden than the Twitter buzz, which is often the case. And then Warren, like, I don't think she was, like, super-duper strong. She was a little bit less assertive than she has been in some past debates. I think she had, like, kind of a somewhat weird answer about, like more people should serve in the military, which seemed like a little bit off-brand. But she also avoided some of the issues that could have been problematic for her, right? Like, healthcare is a segment now that every time it comes up has potential to turn sour on Warren, right? Because she has kind of staked out at this point, frankly, some ambiguity about what her goals really would be. And, like, when you didn't really permit follow-up questions, I thought that did, like, a big favor to her to not allow Cory Booker or Pete Buttigieg or Biden to go another round or anyone else, right? That was a big bullet avoided. I mean, in some ways, I thought she and Buttigieg had parallel debates, right? Where, like, I don't think they were, like, objectively that strong, but they avoided, through some combination of other candidates being reluctant and the moderation not encouraging conflict, they avoided fights that they had the potential to lose.
We have more to get into. We're going to talk about some of the polling that we've done with Ipsos leading up to this debate. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Hims. 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35. And once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. No snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements, just prescription solutions backed by science. No more awkward in-person doctor visits or long pharmacy lines. 4hims connects you to real doctors online, which could save you hours, and it's completely confidential and discreet. Answer a few quick questions, a doctor will review, and if they determine it's right for you, can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that is shipped directly to your door. Order now. Listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today. While supplies last and subject to doctor's approval, see website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy somewhere else. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's forhims.com/538. 4hims.com/538. We're back, and as we've been doing with these Democratic primary debates, we are conducting a panel poll with the help of Ipsos, asking people who watch the debate how their views evolve kind of once they've watched it and then in the days afterwards. So, Sarah, can you just give us a baseline for what we saw when we first conducted this poll before people watched the debate?
Yeah, so going into the debate, there's this question that we ask of who voters are considering, and they're allowed to pick multiple candidates. But each time we've asked this, largely speaking, it's been Biden, Warren, and Sanders clustered at the top, and then Buttigieg and Harris below them. And that's true this time as well. Biden still seems to have a slightly bigger lead than Warren than he did going into the last debate. It'll be interesting to see if there's a shift this time around. I think to the point Nate was making earlier, where it was kind of Warren and Buttigieg in these parallel tracks, not necessarily doing that badly, not doing that great. I mean, I think when that's been true for Warren as well, she still gains in this poll with Ipsos. So it'll be, I'm interested to see if that continues to happen. And then the other questions we ask are on the favorability ratings. And then, of course, what respondents think about a candidate's ability to beat Trump. That remains to be very important to people in this poll. Over two-thirds of respondents say that that matters more than a shared stance on the issues. And then again, Biden continues to lead on this question in terms of voters thinking he has the best ability to beat Trump.
It is interesting that Warren went from 52% considering after the last debate, and she actually did well in our poll of last debate, down to 42.9% in our pre-debate poll this time. So, you know, so something has gone not super well for Warren in the intervening month. You know, there are polls that show her ratings, including in our poll, her numbers on electability are a bit down after having made progress for a period of time. You know, she did not take the opportunity to position herself more toward the center, which she could have. I mean, she had that exchange with Booker over the wealth tax, which is, we should say, a position where she's been both more consistent, and that polls a lot better than with general election voters and Medicare for All. The wealth tax is actually a pretty darn popular idea. But I don't know. I mean, like, a lot of this comes down to, like, how durable you think the trends of the past few weeks are, right? Is this Buttigieg surge like a Herman Cain kind of Rick Santorum-y surge, right? Well, Santorum had some staying power in 2012, I guess it was. It's actually in some ways like not the worst comp for Buttigieg, right, in terms of an Iowa-focused candidate. Do you buy this kind of Warren slump, or is this, you know, like a dead cat bounce? Is like when someone falls a lot, a stock falls a lot, then it kind of bounces back for a few weeks. It's like the opposite of that, right, where you rise a lot and then there's some misgivings, but fundamentally she's raised a lot of money and a lot of people like her, and she is pretty good in these debates. This one, maybe not her best debate, right? So, you know, will she rebound? Is this Klobuchar surge, this mini little surge at all for real? Is there this talk about other candidates getting in? Will that persist? I mean, you have not had Deval Patrick make a very big impact. He had to cancel an event today because only two people showed up, apparently, in New Hampshire, I think it was.
Yeah.
Maybe not New Hampshire, but only two people showed up wherever he was having an event today.
You mentioned Klobuchar, and one thing that she mentioned repeatedly throughout the night was her electability. It's something she's talked about before as well, but that she's won in Minnesota in all kinds of different districts, and that, you know, she can do it again. Is there reason to believe, is there a relationship, clear relationship, between somebody overperforming their benchmarks in a Senate election or a gubernatorial election and then going on to be more electable in a presidential election? Can we take Klobuchar's experience in Minnesota and say, well, therefore, she's more likely to overperform in those kinds of districts, purple districts or red districts nationally?
Look, I think Klobuchar fits the profile of a typical nominee in the sense of being not too young, not too old, not too inexperienced, not too far to the left, not too far to the center, right? She kind of, on paper, has a sort of resume that nominees tend to have. She's also from a swing state. So if nothing else, she is relatively moderate from the Midwest, which is the most important kind of electoral region right now, and a swing state itself, Minnesota. So if nothing else, like, those are things that empirically we can say probably matter. If there is some regionalism in the Electoral College, big debate, but we think the evidence mostly agrees with the notion that if you're more moderate, that you tend to do a pinch better.
Wait, but in terms of, like, your previous elections actually indicating if you'll repeat
that kind of
success.
It's probably, she has a lot more credentials than Mayor Pete to say that people in districts that voted for Donald Trump have voted for him. It's like literally true in the case of Klobuchar, whereas Buttigieg is in a somewhat liberal small town in Indiana, right, and did not do very well when he ran statewide. And so she can make that claim. And that's, you know, look, the argument, the threshold for, like, electability arguments is pretty low, I think. And so I think by the low threshold, that's a somewhat compelling case for Klobuchar, but that's not her only electability argument.
Right. I mean, I think, too, with Klobuchar, if she does, you know, have a surge beyond the early states, say she starts really competing with Buttigieg here, they're largely competing, well, not competing for necessarily, but have the same base currently. And it's the same problem that Buttigieg and Warren have. You know, no one is really making a dent into Black voters. And, you know, maybe that's going to change as Biden continues to make gaffes in the debates, but it hasn't yet. And I think, you know, outside of the first two states, Iowa and New Hampshire, you really need a candidate whose base is beyond, you know, white college educated voters. And we don't really see that yet with them. Or Klobuchar, for that matter, despite the electability arguments.
One thing that struck me is that the debate opened with a question about impeachment, but almost every candidate who was asked about impeachment pivoted from the case at hand, which is, you know, Donald Trump's requests of Ukraine, etc., to something about the people, economics, you know, I will fight, you know, corruption, all of these things that were not specifically just spending a bunch of time attacking the president. What was the political logic behind that, Sarah?
You know, there's not that much differentiation between the candidates on this. They're all like, yes, I support the inquiry into President Trump. He's got to go. That's why I'm running for president, right? And so honestly, it's, you know, they want to focus on 2020 and what's ahead for them. And I think that's honestly, too, one reason why the timeline that you keep seeing circulated for, you know, when will this hit the Senate is in early January, because I do think there's some level of political calculus at play here that Democrats are like, okay, if we vote on this and it moves through the House, it won't through the Senate, at least as things currently stand. And we want to shift back to 2020 and these candidates. And, you know, aside from Biden, who has become a central figure in this because of his son's involvement in the Ukraine, I don't think there's a lot to be gained for the other candidates in terms of talking about this a lot.
Yeah, and the moderators didn't seem particularly interested in asking a lot about it beyond the first few minutes. But then there's this other question of, will this debate even matter, in a sense of, I know, Sarah, you were looking at some of the papers, some websites throughout the debate to see if it was making it above the fold. And it was it?
It wasn't. Yeah. No, I mean, it did at the Post. It did not at the Times. They were still running their impeachment coverage, and they were also live blogging and obviously covering this in depth as well. And so I do find that interesting. Like, you know, tomorrow's headlines and the aggregators, is it going to be primarily Sondland focused and his testimony today or the debate? And I think it's always hard immediately after the debate to be like, okay, here's what the narrative was. But I mean, I think it's a testament to the three of us kind of struggling a little bit here to land on what it is that, yeah, maybe this debate really doesn't move things in the way that others have to some extent.
It's also funny because there's only now after this, there's a debate in December and then a debate in January and then Iowans vote. So we're kind of getting down to the wire here. Nate, you've been spending a lot of time looking into historical data as you build the model on this. Like, how volatile do we expect things to be in the next 2 months? Do things kind of really shake up in the run-up to Iowa?
Sometimes not. I mean, polls don't usually move on their own, right? They move because of events like debates. They certainly move once the primaries start. You know, they can move in Iowa where voters are paying more attention. It can have its own kind of rhythms. And then that has like knockoff effects on the rest of the campaign, potentially. After the last debate, you had not particularly strong movement in the first week or so in polls. You had actually some of the same, too. Buttigieg and Klobuchar moving up a little bit and Bernie moving up a little bit at Warren's expense. But like everything was within like a point or so. It was pretty small. And then kind of, then like a narrative took hold that kind of magnified on itself a little bit, and Buttigieg got some good polls that kind of furthered that narrative, and all of a sudden Warden couldn't find a poll, which is actually leading Biden nationally. And so these things can build on themselves in ways that frankly are a little bit like, and I use the term literally, like a little bit chaotic in the sense of kind of chaos theory. They're kind of complex feedback loops. Things can be very kind of boring and static for a long period of time and then shift somewhat randomly and unpredictably. It has not been a particularly volatile race, you know, so we were kind of below average on volatility until recently.
Yeah. I mean, Warren got the highest marks in our poll right after the debate. So it was a couple weeks after, as you were saying, that you actually started to see a dip in her poll numbers, which I thought was interesting, too, like the narrative building you're talking about. And I think healthcare probably again for her, but it wasn't immediately after, which was interesting.
Right. We've talked about this plenty, that media framing matters a lot here.
So if,
right?
if we're taking off on that, like what substantive issues came up in this debate that could have legs, right? Because usually people judge based on gaffes or how someone's outfit looks, right? Or who told a funny joke. And those things don't seem to matter or have very much staying power, or even who attacked who, right? But like, who made a big tactical shift tonight? I mean, maybe I go back a little bit to Booker kind of raising his hand and saying, hey, if you're someone who wants someone who is moderate enough, but not Joe Biden, you know, I'm going to play that role potentially. Like, that seems interesting.
On the
maybe.
Wealth tax. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that becomes the next big thing. Because otherwise, substantively, I was, again, kind of struggling with, well, what other issues are coming out of this that, right, will have the staying power. Yeah.
I mean, look, a lot of it is like, is there a media narrative that develops around Booker or Klobuchar or maybe Harris? And I don't know. I mean, I think the impeachment factor is probably as important in this debate as any other, because it does like drown out news cycles. And there's not the need to like have a counterintuitive take against conventional wisdom when you can just say, okay, there's a really important impeachment hearing going on tomorrow. And yeah, it's Biden. And then Warren, Sanders, Mayor Pete, some order. We'll revisit this in December, right?
All right. Well, it's getting late. Let's leave things there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Galen.
One last check-in on Gordon Sondland. Where is he?
I think over Birmingham, roughly England.
Okay, fair enough. My name is Galen Druk. Kevin Ryder is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.